So after a break during Advent and Christmas, we're going to return to our study of 1 Corinthians. And we are now beginning essay number 4, which deals with the topic of women and men in the church. And the first part of this essay deals with leading in worship. Now, here from the study Bible notes, from the commentary reading the New Testament, from the commentary, New International Commentary on the New Testament, and from Ken Bailey's Paul Through Mediterranean Eyes, the outlines that include the passage that we are going to be discussing. Problems in regards to corporate worship. And head covering. Head coverings and worship. Or prayer and prophecy. Different though equal in the Lord. Or in the third commentary here, women and men in worship. And finally, Bailey, men and women leading in worship. So that's kind of the headings that commentaries have given to this passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 2 through 16. Now, the rhetoric here is a very elaborate 1 plus 11, so a total of 12-part ring composition. And it begins in verse 2, which is actually an introduction to this entire essay and is not strictly a part of the rhetorical structure. So we're going to begin by reading this as it is found in the English Standard Version. "Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God."
Oh boy.
The center of this first part of the essay is verse 10, 7f. That is why a wife ought to have symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Now, you'll notice that sprinkled throughout, I did not read the parenthetical words or phrases. And we'll get to all of that. So some first thoughts. The traditional interpretation that has been given to this passage by many Christian churches throughout the centuries is that verse 3, which reads, "But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God," speaks to a hierarchical authority. In other words, head means headship. And the creation accounts that are referenced in, that are alluded to in verses 7 through 9 and 12, is evidence of male priority and thus headship. And finally, the center, verse 10, Paul is commanding women to be subordinate to men in worship. And this line of reasoning also brings in chapter 14, verse 34, where Paul commands women to be silent in church. And finally, verse 16 is where Paul is apparently telling the Corinthian church that this is the norm and practice in all of the churches in the region. So that's the traditional interpretation. The traditional interpretation is based on an overly simplistic and a tradition-conditioned reading. Modern scholars differ widely in interpretation and run the gamut in the views of this passage. Most agree that this is a very difficult section to interpret. And many agree that Paul is not primarily addressing women's roles in worship. He is addressing women, but not necessarily women's roles in worship. So what are some of the difficulties? First, it involves a translation of the use of words that are found in this passage. The first contentious translation is the term kephali, which is translated head. But it can also mean source or the origin of. And the way Paul mixes the metaphorical as well as the literal use of head poses a problem for interpreters. Which applies where? Where does he literally mean head, and where does he metaphorically mean head? And does he ever imply a sort of hierarchy of authority, or does he always mean a source? The next word is anir, which means man or husband. And the other is gynae, meaning woman or wife. When Paul uses these words in this passage, does he intend gender or marital relationship? You'll notice that in the version translation I read, the English Standard Version, the translations are inconsistent. The translators sometimes use man or woman, and sometimes use husband or wife for the same word. Where it is more proper and appropriate if it's used consistently. But in the English Standard Version was translated by a committee and an editorial team that tends towards a hierarchical, patriarchal, complementarian viewpoint. And so they want to bring out, or they want to read into it, marital hierarchy.
If you're going, am I correct that you said sometimes woman is, the same word is sometimes used for woman and sometimes used for wife?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the same thing for husband and man?
Yeah.
But you also said the same thing for head.
Head and source.
So if we're going to use the same interpretation for man or husband throughout, so we should always say, are we going to agree to always say one word when we do the same
thing? Within a passage, unless there are clear reasons for differentiation, translators ought to stick to using a single English word.
So are we
going to
do that with head?
Yes. The next word is what's katakalipto, meaning cover or veil. Is it a head covering? Is it hair? Or is it some kind of veil over the face?
Did you came to church today?
Yes, you did. And then there's this little preposition called dia, which is translated for. Woman was created for man, which is how it's often translated. But it can also mean because of. Woman was created because of man. or Malchia because of man.
That could change things.
And
with that discussion, we need
9 is, for man was not created because of woman, but woman because of the man.
Oh. Interesting.
Instead of, neither was man created for woman, but woman for man.
Mm-hmm. That takes away the concept of the woman being the man's possession.
Possession is made of woman also.
And there would be no more further men on this planet if it were not. Which it also says.
True.
Finally, the last term found in verse 10 is this authority. So what is authority? The Greek there is exousia, which means authority, but it can also mean freedom or right. And we have seen this word used in the previous essay multiple times in regards to Paul and his own rights and freedoms as an apostle and as a Christian.
Wait, so when it says that's why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, she could also have a symbol of freedom on her head.
Yeah, and the symbolism is not in the Greek. It's the translator's addition.
She could... So, in other words, the wife has freedom on her head.
That's what it could mean.
That's very, very different than authority.
Well, the term authority doesn't necessarily mean boss. When you have authority to do something,
it could also
you have
mean
the freedom to do something.
That the woman has authority.
Right.
That's not how it's been presented.
Yeah, so what is meant by the symbol of authority? That is the key, that's the key question of this essay.
My Bible says power.
Oh, okay. So if you say it's power,
that's
freedom, authority,
is
it talking about someone has power over her because it's on her head? Or does it mean she has power?
Yeah, so this verse 10, does it mean that the woman is to be subordinated? Or does it, or to wear a symbol that identifies the right of a woman to lead in worship?
I only have my Bible and I don't have your study lessons right now. Can you read 10 in your version again? What's the word after power or authority?
On her head.
Well, where's this?
That is why, or because of, dia, gyne, excalcia, kephali, dia, angels.
That is why a woman should have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels.
Right. Okay. But somewhere you were just talking about an authority over. Where's the word over?
It doesn't.
I think I use the word over because we tend to think of the authority over the woman because the authority is on her head.
Right. But in here you didn't read that the man has authority over.
But that's the way it's presented. That's the way this passage is presented, is that the authority is over the woman.
A symbol of authority, though, usually is like that, just as I for it to be here.
Yeah. And have we ever heard this passage presented that way?
Somebody ought to send this to the General Conference compared to the Southern California Conference.
The other problem with verse 10 is what the heck does angels have to do with anything here? Well, it's kind of confusing.
That's weird too. Where do the angels come in?
And then in verses 14 through 15, Paul writes about the argument from nature. Nature kind of prescribes this order of things. Well, what does he mean by that?
Doesn't he have somewhere that the angels had to take off their something off?
Mm-hmm. No, not in this verse. Somewhere in the Bible,
where?
The angels had to take off their something in wheat.
Their crowns or something? Well, I don't know.
I don't know. Crowns off and weeping or something.
I have no idea.
But maybe that crown is their symbol of authority.
Now, another problem is the actual historical context is truly lost to us. So we do our best to try to reconstruct what Paul was trying to address, but at best it's an educated guess. Some guesses are better than others. Some are worse. But ultimately, we have to say we don't know for sure.
Okay, just to back up, just one clarification, just for curiosity. The lack of a hat is the authority.
I don't know.
Men are supposed to take their hat off, and women are supposed to put their hat on.
Because of this, the woman should have authority on the head because of the angels.
Well, verse 7, the man ought not to cover his head, and the woman is supposed to cover their head. So we twisted this. Isn't he saying the hat and the hair is the same thing? You're supposed to wear a hat, you're supposed to wear your hair. Women are supposed to have hats and hair. Men are supposed to not have hats, right?
That's reading modern society into the verses.
So is Paul asking an individual, because Paul has never written to an individual man or woman ever in the entire context of this whole principle.
He's writing to a church.
He's writing to a church. He's writing to a group of people. He is not writing to individual men and women about their places and their relationships of authority or subservient man and wife relationships.
That means that men and women are all sitting and they're listening to this letter together equally.
Right.
Well, not just that. He's not addressing you or him or me.
A particular person. He's addressing people in general.
And people's place in the church. But everybody keeps taking it as an individual, my marriage, or this person, or that, and it's not that. Mm-hmm. He's trying to explain that your place is men and women in this church. And I think when he's saying man and wife, he's considering God and the church, and our place with him in the church, because we are the wife of the church. And I'm sure that's what he'll say is maybe, but I find it that the more I listen to Corinthians, the more I listen to Paul, the more I take everything indirectly, and the better I understand it. Mm-hmm. If I take everything saying, well, I need to do this to myself to be this, then I get everything wrong every time.
Well, in this passage, man and woman are literal man and woman.
Okay.
They're not symbolic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
But the covering and the hat, in verse 7, ought not to cover his head. So men are not supposed to, and women are supposed to. So
that's what it says.
So the absence of the hat is the... If we are assuming that men have power over women, if that's the subject, this, the absence of the hat is what I'm trying to just talk about. Which, in our way of thinking, it's backwards.
So let's continue. So let's look at the first verse 2. Intro number 0. First, Paul begins with a commendation. I commend you. This is in contrast to what Paul is going to write immediately after this first part of the essay in verse 17. Paul is going to say, I do not commend you.
Mm.
In the next section, Paul is going to write about the problems of communion, the Eucharist.
Right.
So this is the first hint is that this present topic of men and women and head coverings is not really a big issue for Paul. It's not a huge concern for him. He's going to talk about it, but it's not a big concern.
It's been a propaganda of translators through the church and their opinion to have a subservient wife and a dominant male figure, pro you know, given through the ages. That's what they've wanted to say. That's how they've interpreted it. So that's how it's been there.
Right.
And that's a meager part of the whole bigger picture of
yes.
part of Paul's argument.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Which has been turned the other way around, and that's been the big part of the article.
Yeah, notice that the center of this essay is going to be the hymn to love, chapter 13. Uh-huh. That's going to be Paul's main point of this essay.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Now, in regards to tradition, so Paul wrote that, you know, and maintain the traditions even as I have delivered it to you. Ken Bailey suggests that, contrary to some opinions, Paul did not create his own version of Christianity, but joined and passed on what was already being taught. What he writes is, Paul did not create a movement, he joined one.
Mm-hmm.
And what Ken Bailey has shown is that in each of the essays that make up 1 Corinthians, Paul opens each of them by an appeal to tradition. Maintain the tradition. Well, this is the tradition that you have been given.
Appealing to tradition. Promoting it.
So, the problem...
The traditions of man or the of God. Paul talked about that. Traditions are way down the ladder from law.
But all teachings essentially are traditions.
So that verse that I was referring to isn't so much as traditions. It's not that it's a tradition, it's that it was a man, not a God.
Correct. The problem with the Protestant Reformation is that it threw out all church traditions.
Uh-huh.
It threw the baby out with the bathwater, as you might say.
Uh-huh.
There are some traditions that are good.
Uh-huh.
Now what Luther... What Calvin, etc., were against were not all traditions, per se,
mm-hmm.
but those the abuses of traditions.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because my Bible uses the word focus. This is a little different.
Okay. Now we get to the first part of the actual essay, Intro 1. But now, at least some appear to be deviating from some of the traditions that were given. And now we get to the word head. Is Paul appealing to hierarchy and accompanying authority structures? Paul, this is from the New International Commentary. Paul's understanding of the metaphor, therefore, and almost certainly the only one the Corinthians would have grasped, is head as source. Especially meaning source of life.
Okay.
And same commentary, Gordon Fee writes, there is no indication that Paul intends any kind of hierarchy to be read into this statement.
Wow, so he's saying that a man's head and a woman's head is her source of life.
So, yeah, so this is how it ought to be read. Now I want you to understand that the origin of every man is Christ. The origin of a woman is man, and the origin of Christ is God. And with the origin, you might say source of life. But I want you to remember that the source of life of every man is Christ, the source of life of a woman is man, and the source of life of Christ is God.
That's totally different from an authority over. That's totally different from man is head, is authority over a woman. Man is the source of life to the woman.
Is he saying that man was created and woman came out of the right rib?
Was created from man.
Created from man. And could it also be that the woman would have a hard time existing without man because the man... works and brings home food and promotes
probably not
life. No, she was created from man, so the man is the source of life for the woman.
That
okay.
fits in with what it says further
that,
down that
that,
know,
makes
that
sense.
Being said, now it, when men come from women now too, women are the source of men.
Right.
Too, because
men are the source of women
originally.
But, But now the woman is also the source of the man.
Says Mary Soul, this is true because woman came from man, but also man is born from woman.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so is it man, woman, or is it husband, wife, as some translations
translate
it? No, is Paul speaking to marriage, or is it in its apparent hierarchy, or is he speaking to just genders? Again, we talked about this already. The English Standard Version, as well as many others, it's inconsistent. They mix the terms.
Right.
So a couple of better translations that are consistent include the New English Translation and the Common English Bible, where it keeps it as man and woman throughout.
Uh-huh.
That makes more sense to me.
Yeah. Especially if you're saying the woman came from the man, and that's not talking about a marriage relationship.
Right. So the problem, again, there's another problem. The problem of seeing head, the word head, as promoting some kind of hierarchy is that if this text is seen that way, we must also accept that Christ is subordinate to the Father.
Ew.
That's a heresy that was rejected very early on.
Okay. God is the boss and Christ obeys him, and that we're not going to go there.
And it should not be seen as about marriage because it begins every man, and every can be seen as carrying over the next phrase in verses 4 and 5. It's talking about every man and every woman, not just husbands and wives, not just married relationships.
Okay.
So what Paul is doing in verse 3 is making a theological statement about the source of life. Not about hierarchy and subordination. Christ created man. The woman was created from man. And Christ depended upon his Father for life while he was here on this earth.
Right, right.
That's the theological statement Paul is making.
Uh-huh.
So, to clarify what you just said, Christ relied upon God while he was on this earth. And that's what Paul's talking about.
Yeah.
He's not talking about the origin of Christ and the power of Christ.
No.
Or the authority of Christ versus God.
Right.
So, what is the problem that Paul is attempting to address? There are many different opinions, but here are two. The first comes from the New International Commentary by Gordon Fee. The eschatological woman were casting off their societal norms and traditions because Christianity had ushered in a sexless, genderless age and could appear in public without elements to distinguish their gender.
Mm-hmm.
These women believe that because they were now living in the kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven, that they were like angels. And that they no longer... they had... we might say, evolved beyond sexual distinctions.
Yeah.
This is what he writes. Let's see. From chapter 11, verse 16, it appears that the general practice in the Pauline churches was for women to keep their heads covered during worship. To cover the head was an act attesting a woman's sexuality. To remove the head covering, moreover, was a social symbol of one's transcendence of her sexuality. In Joseph and Asenath, a pre-Christian Hellenistic Jewish propaganda tract, Asenath is a virgin converted to Judaism through the agency of an archangel. Afterwards, he orders her to remove her clothes of mourning and put on radiant garments. This she does, including a head covering. When she returns, the angel orders her to take off the head covering because you are a holy virgin today and your head is as that of a young man. That is, in this Hellenistic Jewish document, Asenath is believed to have transcended her sexuality as the result of her religious experience. With the transcendence of her femaleness goes the discarding of the social symbols of that sexuality.
Weird.
So that's one way of looking at the possible problem that was happening in the Corinthian church. The second possible way of looking at the problem is that the church had worshipers from both Jewish and Greco-Roman backgrounds, worshiping together.
Yeah.
Jewish women were expected to keep their hair covered. It was thought to be sexually enticing, among other things.
Right.
There is some evidence that it was only prostitutes that kept their heads uncovered.
Ooh.
In any case, uncovered women's hair would have been a distraction during worship. Paul is discussing appropriate clerical garb.
Okay.
Word clerical garb.
It's from Ken Bailey.
Where the word clerical, how'd that come in here?
Yes, exactly. That's what I was getting at when I was talking about Paul. He might have been speaking individually to man and woman, but he was basically just addressing the general practice of church etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, which is what he's done a lot.
We'll get to it in this next part of the discussion, but who Paul is discussing right now is those who are leading worship.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, so that's where he's referring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got it.
Oh, that's where verse 4, that's okay. What verses were you reading?
This is still verse 3.
Okay, but I think. Verse 4 we talk about, for those who are praying or prophesying, so yeah, okay, I need to.
Mm-hmm.
So what Paul, this is from Bailey again, he writes, from the outset it is clear that the issue is gender distinction, not gender subordination.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants people to know whether the person up front leading worship, because their voice probably for some reason isn't enough to distinguish, and that's a man or woman.
No, he doesn't want all the teenage boys falling in love with the lady that's giving the thing, because she's suggesting with her head uncovered that she's available.
The example Ken Bailey gives is, in a church, a woman leading worship in a very short miniskirt or something.
Yeah.
Got it.
Very revealing, you know, top. You know, it's not that she shouldn't wear it, but when you're leading worship, let's not be distracting. Let's not be drawing attention to yourself.
So in that culture, if you're leading worship, cover your hair. Hello?
This is perfectly clear. This is perfectly clear to these people. They understood it completely.
But like you were saying, the cultural nuances aren't lost.
Well,
you're
considering the usual Sunday clothing fair for young women in church nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. That would have been considered. I mean, you wouldn't. That'd be like going to a Muslim community without your face covered nowadays. I mean, just,
yeah, yeah.
Think of that as like, oh, wow, that's really revealing. Well, that's the same.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Their head being uncovered is just as much as pulling a little veil from below your nose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, now we get into the actual ring composition structure of 2, 3, and 11, 12, where Paul discusses men and women who are offering prayers and prophesying.
Mm-hmm.
Prayers can be offered in private, but prophesying is a public act.
Yeah.
But
so
we're talking about at church, so praying generally is the person up front.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, men and women are both leading worship and offering words and teaching from God in worship.
Okay.
Paul has no problems with the act of women leading churches, worship and teaching. In fact, it is most likely that because they met in homes, that women were actually most of the leaders in the early churches.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So what is the problem with men and covering his head while leading worship? We don't know precisely. It's a couple of explanations that are given. It may be considered a sign of mourning, and it is inappropriate to worship God in this way.
Okay.
Where people play signs of head covering as a sign of mourning. The other is that in the Middle East, a servant is expected to cover his head in the presence of his master, but Jesus considers his people friends and not servants or slaves. And so to continue to consider Jesus as a master is to deny the intimacy that he offers.
Hmm. Okay.
What also works is when you started out, you said ordinances, which I mean, my Bible says ordinances, and you said
traditions.
It's what the people are used to. And to be honest with you, I'm not used to you wearing a cap. But when we went south, one of the churches, one of the young men, actually wore a baseball-type cap throughout his whole time that he was serving up front. And it was unusual to me. And that's kind of what he's saying is here.
Could that be a distraction?
If it wasn't a normal tradition, and that's what he says, tradition ordinances. So...
And in that way, a man covering his head in that culture would also be, whoa, that's weird, a distraction. Like a woman uncovering her head to speak up front would be, she would be saying, hey, come visit me afterward.
And then they have all these big Sunday hats that people wear.
So this makes sense why men shouldn't be covered if that was their normal tradition.
So we don't know what the tradition was for men.
We don't know what it is.
Uncovering.
Yes.
So what about the women? First, important note is that Paul says nothing about women who are part of the congregation.
Okay.
He does not instruct them to cover their heads.
Uh-huh.
It's only those who are leading in worship.
So if you want to wear a mini skirt to church next week, Sarah,
as long as
you're not a
part of
your
church. I feel a pull. So in this problem that Paul is addressing, Paul could have ended all the controversy by commanding women to stop leading worship. Well, that could have,
but he didn't.
But he says, when women are leading, what did he say?
He said, you know, for the woman to go up there without a hat on, she might as well go up there shaven. Well, that would be shocking. So all he's saying is, go do shocking things.
Yeah, so what Paul is saying is, women's hair has sexual connotations and is distracting to worshippers. Please leave it covered when up front.
But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. So he's implying right there. Every wife who prays or prophesies with her
head uncovered.
Yes.
If we're talking about sexual connotations, if this guy's wife goes up front with her hair down in this culture, she's dishonoring him.
That's a possible interpretation.
But this verse right here implies that the women are praying and prophesying, in other words, leading worship.
Yeah.
But people use this verse to say that women shouldn't.
To be careful with this, I don't see any reference of a woman being a wife. It's just a woman.
Right.
It's not.
I said wife because I was... Mm-hmm. Just reading out of my translation. But
this woman in verse 5 could have been a wife to a non-Christian.
True.
I mean, you said that most of the groups are led by women.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And my guess is if there's more women than men around, then there
especially may... in this particular movement?
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
That very likely could be the case.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah.
He's encouraging them to set an example of non-shocking behavior.
I don't want the Christian church to be considered like womanizing, women stealing the men away from the Jewish church because of their siren type ways.
That's where you go if you want to watch whores prophesy in church.
No wonder they went to all the degraded little mining camp towns and stuff like that.
Oh my. That's weird. That's really cool.
Paul,
I think that is a new way.
Paul offers another hyperbolic, hypothetical solution. Since the hair connotes sex and is distracting, if women shave it off, it would solve the problem too.
And there was a big demand.
Yeah, but it is shameful, and the word shameful does not mean right, necessarily morally right or wrong. It just means...
embarrassing.
dishonoring.
Yeah.
Dishonoring, not according to tradition or societal norms. It is shameful for a woman to look like a man, so why not accept the simpler solution of just covering it up? And then Paul gets back to the men. Men with long hair look like women and therefore are considered shameful in that society.
That's relative.
That's what he says, in that society.
Yes.
Well, no, it's relative because Jesus supposedly had longer hair.
This is Greco-Roman society, not Jewish.
Okay. But what they consider long versus what we consider long today may not be the same length.
Maybe true.
Roman and Greek had very short hair. Roman and Greek women.
Because they cut it, or because it just grew short.
They cut it.
Roman and Greek women.
Men.
No, men.
Oh, men. Okay, men had very short hair.
So today.
Military.
Yeah, that's probably why.
So Jews have long hair.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Back in those days, there was a difference in hair between a Greek and a Roman and a Jew.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was very much so. Did you guys see any of the art?
The art is active then. Yeah.
Atlas, Hercules, all of them, they all have short hair.
And this was written to the Greeks. Corinthians were
Disney and Hercules.
This was written to a mixed society in a Greco-Roman culture.
So what would a Jew say about having long hair? Reading this about men should not have long hair.
Jews outside of Judea and Galilee probably had conformed more towards Greek and Roman styles.
Because that was the culture they lived in.
Well,
but in Judea,
in the culture,
maybe
they
yeah, yeah. In Judea, it might have been more fashionable for men to wear longer hair. But men in other areas, even if they were Jewish, that wasn't the style they wore.
What we consider fashion, we probably consider absolute.
Tradition.
Yeah. Jewish men, though, in their societies also had very distinction. Very distinct style for their hair, like they do nowadays. Anyways, I mean, you look at a Hasidic Jew walk down the streets of New York, and there's no,
and their identity is obvious.
It's very,
very.
Finally, here, Paul in verse 16 writes that they really shouldn't be having a controversy over this issue. No, it's a simple problem with a simple solution. Paul's appeal is to tradition or nature. He doesn't appeal to scripture. So this is the second hint that this is an issue that doesn't concern Paul all that much. He's writing about it because it's come to him.
Huh.
What does "we have no such custom"? What does "such" refer to?
Women uncovered.
Okay.
So, like, in daily life, it doesn't really matter, but if you're going to get up front, so that's a good example of modesty.
So, this is...
What are the churches of God? Is that the Jewish ones?
All Christian churches, regardless.
Corinthians and all.
So, once again, this is Paul, like, kind of complaining at the Corinthians again for making him have to talk about something that he really shouldn't have to talk about.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so this is from Gordon Fee in International Commentary, writes that he is dealing strictly with custom, church custom to be sure, is now made plain, as is the fact that this argument, for all its various facets, falls short of a command as such. First, the very fact that Paul argues in this way, and that even at the end he does not give a commandment, suggests that such a church custom, although not thereby unimportant for the Corinthians, is not to be raised to canon law.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the word for custom?
Tradition,
nature.
No. In verse 16, how that custom were different than ordinances and tradition of verse 2.
Semantically, nothing.
Semantically, does that mean the actual word?
No. I don't know what the actual words are. because I didn't think it was important.
But this is, yeah. So 16 and 2 go together? Yeah, 16 mm-hmm. and 2 go together.
No, sir.
16 and 4 and 5 go together. Now we get to sections 4 and 10, the C's. And so reads, "For a man ought not cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, and woman is the glory of man. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered?" Paul alludes to creation accounts of Genesis 1 and 2 in this passage.
Okay.
And part of that Genesis account is that man was created first, woman created second.
Yeah.
So does that mean, therefore, the one that came first is more important?
I've also heard it said that God said, "I can do better than that."
So this is the frequent argument made for patriarchy and female subordination is that God created man first and woman second. Therefore, males are meant to rule and females to submit.
Yeah.
That's not what it says in Genesis.
But is this correct?
That man couldn't live by himself.
Yeah, the difficulty with this conclusion is that the creation stories begin with the lesser forms of life and move on to the more advanced forms. If created,
I can do better than that.
If created earlier equals more important, then animals are more important than people, the plants are more important than the animals, and the primitive earth without form and void is the most important of all.
Oh my goodness. The epitome.
Paul does not say woman is the image of man, because that would contradict Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27, where all of humanity, the word Adam can refer to a single person. But it can also be in the plural form, meaning all of humanity. And in Genesis 1, the word Adam is the plural form, meaning all humanity.
So Adam means people in general. Okay, not just men or man.
So in Genesis 1, all of humanity is created in God's image, both male and female.
Yeah.
Woman is the glory of man is what Paul writes. It could be understood to mean that woman is the crowning act of creation, the glory of all humankind. Or it could mean that just as man's existence brings honor and glory to God, the woman's existence brings honor and glory to man. Again, Paul is writing not about roles and authorities, but about honor in relationships. Or, again, it could mean something that is totally lost to us. Paul returns to social conventions. Men's heads should be uncovered in leading worship, and women's heads should be covered in leading worship. In other words, what Paul is trying to get at is what's going to result in the least friction among worshipers of differing cultural traditions.
Mm-hmm.
He's being very practical and pragmatic. Then we get to the D's, 5 and 9. Which read, "For man is not from woman, but woman is from man. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God." Paul is basically saying, arguing about who came first, and therefore who has authority over the other, is a meaningless argument. Because all things come from God.
Uh-huh.
Now, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
He's not asking.
Paul says, yes, woman originated from man, but man, no, today has to be born from woman, so what's your argument? Mm-hmm. We get to the E's, 6 and 8. And it reads, for man was not created because of woman, but woman because of the man. Nevertheless, or more specifically, woman is not independent of man, nor man independent of woman in the Lord. Mm-hmm. Was woman created for man to serve him? Tell many translations.
Yeah, it says
read.
Woman was created for man, meaning.
Yeah, not
she's
so.
Like
yeah,
his possession.
Not so fast. Don't create theologies based on a particular translation of the text when the text could be read just as validly in other ways. Okay. This particular translation is inappropriate use to justify patriarchy and complementarianism in the church. Mm-hmm. What Paul is doing here is, let's see, Gordon Fee in International Commentary writes, Paul really is reflecting the sense of the Old Testament text to which he is alluding. Man by himself is not complete. He is alone, without a companion or helper suitable to him. In Genesis 2, verse 18, the word helper is Ezer. Eve is referred to as Ezerah. Ezer is used to refer to God when he comes to save Israel. Ezer is
not necessarily an underservant kind of helper.
Ezer is not an assistant, but a powerful figure that can even be seen as having superior powers.
I don't know. Hear me.
So, seen in this light, our understanding of the text and of Paul's view of women are transformed. Women for Paul are not created for men. Rather, women, as descendants of Eve, are placed by God in the human scene as the strong who come to help or save the needy, the men. Paul emerges as a compassionate figure who boldly affirms the equality and mutual interdependency of men and women in the new covenant. This view of Paul helps explain why powerful, influential, wealthy women were attracted to Christianity.
Yeah. Because they could have actual authority.
They could, in other religions or whatever, they were still property and didn't have anything. Mm-hmm.
And in the Christian religion, the women could actually matter. They could actually do things that mattered.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Mm-hmm. Is there any religion that does?
Some of Christianity does that. Is there any other religion today that
Wicca.
Okay.
Buddha.
Native American religions. Matriarchal societies.
Than the man because of the birth possibility. Uh-huh. There was always a lot of matriarchal societies all throughout India. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's been many, many, many cultures derived around a matriarchal situation. And elephants are big on the women controlling the scene.
Elephants?
Yeah, elephants are matriarchal.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's what's going through my mind.
The elephants themselves.
We've always studied deeply man and woman during creation and all that. But the animals, male and female, were just created simultaneously. They're within different, all the different animals, there's different relationships within the animals. But I don't know if it's true or not, especially like you say the elephants, but the females don't serve the males, and the males don't serve. They all work together. Animals don't think. Penguins, they have a. I mean, they all have different relationships, but there's not one of actual
superiority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you're a praying mantis.
don't say no, man. I get up.
They eat there.
We don't appeal to the animal kingdom.
That's not our goal.
In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul elaborated on the interdependency of husbands and wives. Uh-huh. So in that essay, Paul was speaking to marital relationships. Uh-huh. In this current passage, Paul broadens it to all men and women in the church. Another reason to dismiss any sort of husband-wife reading into this passage. What Paul is saying is a healthy church requires the leadership of both men and women.
Cool. Okay.
It requires both.
Yeah, balance. If you only have male leadership, then what kind of... You don't have any balance.
The same would be if it was only female.
Yeah. You need to have varying points of view, just like if all the people in leadership in an organization are the same in any other way, you need to have different points of view.
And so now we get to the center, 7. That is why, or because of this, the woman should have authority on the head because of the angels.
Yeah, what's with the angels?
What's with the angels? Well, what's with the whole verse? Is it authority or symbol of authority? And where have we seen the term excelsia recently? Well, we've already mentioned that Paul used it to refer to rights and freedoms.
Okay.
Now, it appears repeated in around chapters 9 and 10 where Paul discusses his rights and freedoms as an apostle and also in the assertion of Corinthian Christians and their rights and freedoms. In the previous essay, it was all about what can I do? The Corinthian assertion was, I can do anything because now I am free. And Paul says, yes, you are free, but your freedom is limited by love. Mm-hmm. I voluntarily restrict my rights so that I will not be a stumbling block.
Mm-hmm. So if the woman has authority on her head, is that different than having a symbol of authority on her head?
So three major lines of interpretation. The traditional interpretation is the head covering as a symbol of subordination to male authority.
Right.
Typically the husband. Mm-hmm. Or metaphorically, the woman is under the authority of a male figure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the
And so if
covering.
You do have a woman leader, they're under the authority of a superior male leader or
yeah.
something like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Bailey suggests that this head covering represents something akin to a crown on a royal head.
Okay.
It symbolizes the right and authority of an office.
Okay.
In the case of women prophets of chapter 11, the head covering represents the right and authority for them to speak and lead in worship.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon Fee writes, he offers the most straightforward interpretation, that is to see it as a right or freedom to choose. So in his reading of this verse, it would read, for this reason, the woman ought to have the freedom over her head to do as she wishes. And this is Fee's preference. The problem with this view is that it seems to contradict the rest of the passage. So how Fee explains this is that for Christians, individual freedom is restricted by responsibility for the common good. In other words, yeah, women, ladies, you have the freedom to uncover your head and lead in worship. But it's not good for the church.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to the angels. What about the angels? Possible interpretations that Gordon Fee presents. First, maybe referring to kind of the mythology of male angels looking down upon women who might lust after them if they're uncovered.
Angels were gender neutral.
A second possible explanation, angels participate in Christian worship, and for some unknown reason, women ought to be governed.
So it's not to seduce the angels?
Or a third explanation, since saints will judge angels, women ought to have the wisdom to exercise proper authority in small matters like head coverings. Fourth possible explanation, the eschatological women thought themselves already like angels without gender, so they thought head coverings were unnecessary, but Paul writes that time has not yet come. Ken Bailey suggests the following. He sees a ring composition within a ring composition, with the center being the woman should have authority on the head. On either side are references to creation. First, Jewish tradition held that angels were present at creation praising God. So in the Genesis account, Jewish tradition explained that angels were present at that creation account praising God. Now, these very same angels are present at the new creation, the creation of the church, the new temple. The climax in the center affirms women in worship leadership and gives them a sign of their authority. A part of this new creation is the restoration of equality and mutual interdependence between men and women in Christ. What Ken Bailey is alluding to is that in Genesis 3, at the story of the fall, what happened was the male domination of women. At the new creation, with the church, the male-female relationship is restored to what it was at creation in Genesis 1 and 2. Instead of one dominating over the other, it's now back to mutual interdependence. Mm-hmm. One cannot live without the other. So,
no longer any attempt at hierarchy.
Yeah. So given that what Paul is addressing is so tied to time and place, does this passage have any relevance for the 21st century church?
It kind of makes a real far-fetched interpretation. Mm-hmm. In the Old Testament, we talked about the sons of God mingling with the
daughters of men.
Yeah, and that was, there's been 10,000 different interpretations of that. But regardless, that's an essential relationship between godly and ungodly. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's saying, women, dress nicely so that you don't tempt our saintly men.
Probably not.
That's a good question. So, in answer to your question, does it have any bearing on our modern church? I believe it goes beyond the man and the woman side of what we as people should be conducting ourselves in church. I think it's more to all people in church that now we have this great freedom that we've been given. We're not to just go and boast it all around and make it, like you say, a stumbling block for other people.
Right.
So it has a great bearing in our modern church for us to understand that with our freedom, you know, Stan Lee says, comes great responsibility, or with power comes great responsibility. That means that as we stand above people in our pews and in our churches and talk, we should remember our humility and our humbleness to those so that they're not distracted in their worship by listening to us. Exactly. Walking around.
You know,
I think you baby and kind of taking over because I got a baby. But that's, I think it has bearing in that regard.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of things. Today's church faces a very different issue. Should women be allowed full participation in all areas of church ministry is a question that that divides many churches.
Passionately so.
But reading this, not only that this wasn't the issue, but reading this, it says absolutely yes, you have to have that diversity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the solution is not for women to become more like men.
Well, that's what I think. Yeah.
No, Paul would certainly be against that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So the question then is, how can the church live out the mutual interdependence of women and men that Paul preached? How can the church value the gifts of all people, all of its members, equally?
Maybe each member of the church, male or female, or whoever, can explore their own place in the church and figure out where they fit best. I don't know if that's what Paul is saying.
Everywhere.
Because not every person is gifted to fit.
Not every person has the talents for every.
Paul is going to get into spiritual gifts.
Every
spiritual gifts here,
yeah, but not because they're male or because they're female. But maybe each woman and each man can.
I'm agreeing with you. But what there is, some people will say that, well, you just aren't cut out to be in this role. Well, no.
Because you're a woman.
Yes, women won't be cut out to fit that role, but they will do it differently than men. That's okay.
Sure.
But, so we can't just say just because you do it different, then you're not cut out for that role.
Right. So what is Paul saying? I don't know.
Well, I think he's on the other side of things. Right. In those days, there were probably more women in authority.
Uh-huh.
They were sitting on councils and boards and up front.
Uh-huh.
And
especially in the new Christian church that was being created.
Maybe being the president of a conference.
And
no.
So for them to use this chapter in reference to the current issue is actually backwards.
Yeah.
Well, it's appropriate, just not the way you're using it.
Yeah.
It's appropriate to use it, but for the other side.
So, here's a paragraph. The issue, as Paul defines it, seems to be whether redemption, defined as religious experience resulting from Christ, cancels out creation, defined as human sexuality, or whether creation and nature are from God, just as our redemption and being in the Lord. The Corinthian women acted as though their redemption had caused them to transcend their created sexuality.
Oh, I see. So, because I'm a child of God, I'm not a woman anymore.
Paul's posture grows out of his conviction that creation is not canceled by redemption, but rather is enhanced.
Yeah.
Hence,
yeah.
1 Corinthians 11:2 through 16 does not aim to silence Christian women, but to guarantee that in their self-expression, they were not denying an integral part of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, especially when women had been denied full humanity for so long. Then when women were given authority to speak out in church, they might see that as unwomanly, and so see themselves as unwomanly.
Yeah. In corporations, when women become executives, they feel like they have to act more like a man.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
I was saying that the feminist movement of today is basically demeaning in a woman in a sense that it takes away her womanly sense. You know, you have to become more like a man, so you can't be soft and smell good and take care of your kids anymore and be sweet. You have to be hard and rugged and take down freaking corporations with the tall boots, you know.
So what does a woman's power executives clothing look like? Yeah.
So Paul is speaking out against women forsaking their femaleness for Christianity and saying, instead of a woman, I'm now a Christian.
Paul is affirming the full value of woman.
Uh-huh. Women are valued for who they are, without the expectation
and Paul
of
is saying
being more like a man.
There are all roles and positions in the Christian church are open to women.
Uh-huh.
But there is.
And you don't have to become like a man in order to.
But we are
in authority in
our current culture, because in today's society, women try to become men in order to rise a corporate ladder.
Uh-huh.
But in his society, women were taking their hats off, was moving over to the sensual side rather than to the asexual side.
Yeah. Men, I think women were doing the same thing as a woman in corporate America might do, maybe forsaking their femininity in order to be a CEO. And here, women were forsaking their femininity in order to be a church leader.
Yeah,
and he's saying,
because men don't wear that.
Yeah. There's a twist.
Yeah,
but Paul's saying you can be a church leader and a woman.
The idea of the hat coming off of being sexual is also refers to a modern take on things, is the fact that women denying their place as the virtuous woman puts them in the same standard of a lustful relationship that men don't relate as being a good thing toward a woman. They think, oh, now she's just a piece of something that we can all engage in. No longer is there a specialty to that product. No longer do I have to treat it with honor and respect. It's just another person that we can run around and fling with. And that's the thing that I think a lot of people forget, is that with Paul saying, don't take, you know, when you're standing up there, you're degrading the power of the woman being something greater for men to strive toward. You're taking that away, and you're becoming a piece of meat. So,
I think it goes back to one of the earlier quotes. It's about gender distinctions, not gender roles.
Right. He's saying the roles are open to everybody, but don't try to be.
Don't try to be who you're not. In the previous two essays before, where Paul was talking about women and men and kind of marriage relationships, he said the same thing. Don't, because someone else thinks this particular way of life is better, doesn't mean it is. You know, be who you are.
Mm-hmm. The same, yeah, when he was talking about singleness.
Singleness versus married, some were elevating singleness as being superior to being married. And Paul is saying, some people are gifted to be single. Some people are gifted for marriage. Affirm your gifts, work with your gifts. Don't try to be something you're not gifted for.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
And I think in the same way, Paul maybe is portraying gender distinctions as gifts.
Acknowledge who you are. Be who you are. Maximize your role.
And for him, hair and head covering in their culture happened to be the divisive subject of, are you trying to be a man, are you trying to be a feminine woman, or are you trying to be sexual? The three different extremes, or not extremes, but the spectrum, was all portrayed onto a hat and hair.
Yeah, there were signals with what you wore on your head that indicated who you were trying to be. Huh. Okay.